Okay, so in my previous life, I was a radical. Ran a merry band of social activists. Our sole mission, fight the power. We hit the man in the only place he cared about, the pocketbook. My job? Lead the charge. We'd stage actions, organize protests, let the people know about the evil committed against them. Rise up, my brothers and sisters, rise up. Now, one of the wickedest mobs of all turns out to be the tobacco industry. No letters, please. Instead, write the federal courts that found Big Tobacco guilty of running a criminal enterprise, targeting toddlers with poisons and so on. So we organized to stop the targeting of minority communities, to cease marketing to children worldwide, to quit adding dangerous additives to dangerous products, right? And here's the thing I'm most proud of. Smokers themselves join our actions because they don't want to see their kids targeted any more than anyone else. In fact, smokers understand the real war being waged. So our group, smokers, non-smokers, believers, doers, dreamers, good guys, hopers, students, lovers, they were there to support each other, believe in each other, worked in concert with and for the benefit of each other. Trust. Now, you need money to fight the man. So I decided to go to a funding conference, and I asked several of my partners to join me. And one of the biggest funders, the one writing checks with people wearing suits, calls us into a room to tell us about the brand new anti-tobacco initiative. Cool, cool. Fancy woman in a fancy suit, fancy shoes, she stands up to explain. We're so excited about this, we really are. We call it blow the whistle on smoking. What we want you to do is get a bunch of these whistles, see? And then go to college campuses, parks, places of business, and wherever you see someone smoking, that's when you get right up in their face, right up as close as possible, and then you blow the whistle as loud as you can at them and say, I'm blowing the whistle on smoking tobacco. You see? You see how effective this is going to be at changing attitudes? Now the room goes silent. Crickets. Because this is maybe, certainly, the single most stupid idea anyone has ever heard of. Sneak up on unsuspecting people and blow whistles in their face? Hell to the no! We're not going to do that. I can feel heads turning. My people, people I have invited, partners in the struggle, they are waiting for me to say something, say anything to fix this lunacy. But I have a problem. This crazy person has money. I need some of it to make things go. And bazillionaires have to be handled just so. So I stall. Where do we get these whistles? And all of a sudden, the looks of horror, of rage that were directed at the woman, they're now aimed directly at me. Oh, we have plenty. We'll be able to deliver every partner organization as many whistles as they need. And I hear people behind me getting up and walking out. I need to signal to them that I'm still down. I'm still down with the cause. I'll come up with something. I'm still the radical that walked up in here. I just gotta talk the nice lady down. Need a little bit more time, just a little bit more time. But I turn around to a room that's almost completely emptied out. And I know they didn't walk out on her. They walked out on me. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Overthrow. Amazing stories from real people discovering that whomever they're with might not be with them. My name is Glenn Washington. We have got a crazy episode. Please make sure all your papers are in order. Because this is Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now for our first piece, sensitive listeners should know that this story does contain graphic imagery and violence. But it starts on the basketball court. Alex Awumi is an international basketball player. He's played in France, in Macedonia. And for this story, he takes his basketball career to North Africa.
As soon as I got on the flight and I said, man, what am I getting myself into? Because all I knew about the people is what I saw on TV, about people going crazy, buildings getting burned. And when I was on the flight, I had a lot to think about. And I was like, man, I'm about to land in Benghazi and see a bunch of people who don't like Americans.
Please remain seated until the aircraft comes to a complete stop.
Alex Awumi has just touched down in Benghazi, the second largest city in Libya. He's greeted by dozens of fans because, well, he's here to play basketball. The fans follow him to a waiting car, where Mr. Ahmed, his team president, drives him through the streets to his new apartment.
Outside, looking in, you know, when you pull up to the street, it looked run down. I thought that, you know, my stay here would be very short. But when I got up, we got into the building, got up to the top floor. It was basically just this million-dollar apartment, just disguised. As soon as I walked in, it was beautiful. It was like everything was just shining. $1,000 Versace plates, couch with gold trimmings on the edge, flat screens everywhere. You know, the kitchen tile was just extraordinary. And, you know, the smile on my face was just ridiculous.
While Alex is checking out his palace, something catches his eye. A portrait.
You see this huge portrait, literally half the size of a wall, maybe from like the 80s or something, you know, in like a military outfit.
It's a picture of Muammar Gaddafi, the colonel.
And that's when I realized I was playing for the team owned by Muammar Gaddafi and the Gaddafi family. I was just in shock, you know, I was in shock.
You see, Alex was born and raised in a small village in Nigeria.
You know, Muammar Gaddafi did a lot for the African nation. This guy, some of the poorest countries in West Africa, North Africa, he helped rebuild with his own fortune. My dad, you know, had a portrait of him and Nelson Mandela. You know, these are two guys that, you know, as a kid, you wanted to strive to be. And that's how I saw him as a child. But growing up, as I moved to America, I didn't really pay attention to news because obviously I was a teenager doing other things, you know. And, you know, what I knew as a child is what I went in there knowing.
Soon, Alex heads over to his first practice. He's nervous and excited to be playing for the royal family. The team is called the Al Nasser Benghazi, and it's made up of Alex, one other international player, and the rest Libyan locals.
When I got there, you know, it wasn't like a typical practice. People were depressed. People just looked scared to be there.
Alex pulls Mustafa, the other international player, to the side. He asks him,
why are the guys scared to make mistakes? Why are they scared to do this? Why are they scared to do that? And he told me, he said, we haven't been winning.
Mustafa admits that their team is on a losing streak and that when they lose, they don't get paid. Well, they do get paid. A visit from the Royal Guards.
You can see, you know, there were actually a couple of black eyes, a couple of bruises on people's bodies. Obviously, people get bruised up in a basketball game, but, you know, some of this stuff you could just tell was done from some other type of damage. If we lose, do I get pushed against a locker in the changing room?
Alex's first game day arrives. His team flies to Tripoli to play its rivals, the best team in the league. The 5,000 cap arena is overflowing with fans and anticipation.
We had some crazy fans. I mean, they throw on toilet rolls, screaming, yelling, burning these big old trash cans inside the arena, which they let them do. I never understood that. As soon as I'm warming up, you know, a man walks in the lower doors of the arena where the teams come out. He has like, all these bodyguards and military with him. My teammates, you know, they kind of get nervous and, you know, stop playing and they're looking at him. And then he walks up to me and he introduces himself as Al-Sadi Gaddafi.
Al-Sadi Gaddafi is one of the colonel's sons.
We just had a conversation about how they were waiting for me, telling us that we need to win the championship. As I was talking to Al-Saadi Gaddafi, he pointed up to the VIP area.
At the top of the arena, in a roped-off section swarming with even more bodyguards, is Colonel Gaddafi.
I made eye contact with the colonel. He nodded. The whole arena saw the eye contact. My teammates were talking about, like, oh, he never comes to games. It's crazy how this is your first game and he shows up. It was kind of nerve-wracking. This team was his baby. They wanted to win. Winning was in their bloodline. So, you know, you don't want to lose when it comes down to something like that. It was a tough game. You're in the region in North Africa where every player is literally athletic because they might not have the same skill set you have, but they could run just as fast as you, they could jump just as high, they're just as strong. But the advantage we had is that our locals were better. They were quicker. They were hungrier. We eventually won the game. I played really well. 19 points, 9 assists, and 8 rebounds. I was the last one to walk into the locker room. Everybody had a smile on their face. Our team managers were high-fiving people. Teammates were hugging each other. People are back to getting paid again. You know, you would thought we won the NBA championship or something. Everything became better after that point. You know, when you win, you know, winning carries everything.
After the big win, Alex becomes a baller. He gets huge bonuses and saw a poster of himself on almost every street corner in Benghazi. Wherever he goes, people would crowd around him and scream his name. Hundreds of fans would come just to watch him practice.
I was like a local celebrity. It was crazy. You know, I would go to these local restaurants and order freshly made pizza and some chicken for dinner, and they told me, like, you don't have to pay anything. I was begging them, like, no, please, let me pay for it. They're like, no, we can't let you pay.
Okay.
Outside my building, there were always little kids playing soccer. You know, when I had 2 or 3 minutes, I would kick the ball around with them before I had to go to practice. When I came back from practice, I would always have some Snickers bar or some M&M's or something where I could just hand out to them all the time.
Fans don't flock to Alex just because he's Benghazi's basketball hero. Alex is also part of the Gaddafi family, and because of this connection, he can enjoy what the Gaddafi family enjoyed.
There were perks, man, I'll be honest with you. When I needed a brand new TV for my apartment with HD, I need all these satellite channels. I need to be able to watch, you know, the Kardashians when I'm home.
I wasted everyone's money. I wasted everyone's everything, and I feel bad.
And literally, it came just like that. Sometimes, you know, it'd be cold. You need a little space heater. Make a call. It comes through. It got to a point where I was, like, kind of abusing my power, to be honest with you. Because I was on Gaddafi's personal team, I felt taken care of security-wise. I think the people that were always around me wouldn't let anything happen to me.
When Alex leaves his royal bubble, hangs out with his teammates, and visits their homes, he sees a different Libya.
Like the projects type. I thought basically when I go into a neighborhood and, you know, I see soldiers carrying guns, I thought this was normal. I was kind of nervous of taking them to where I live because, you know, if they would have saw that, it would, you know, me and my teammates always had conversations about the colonel and his family. It was mixed emotions, you know, people saying that he's not doing anything for the country anymore. He's not giving back to the lower class in the country. Everybody wanted him out as leader, but my mindset and everything I learned about it still stayed the same. Because I was taken care of. It was a Thursday morning, and the night before we had a very intense practice. I went home that night, got some rest, and I was supposed to get up at 9 a.m. to do like a private workout with my coach, and my driver was supposed to come pick me up. He never showed up. I was like, you know, let me go upstairs and see what's going on from the rooftop. So I go up there. I see, you know, hundreds of people basically outside the street. It was nonviolent protest. Nobody had any, you know, guns or knives or whatever. You know, they had a couple flags out there. You know, I'm like, okay, this has been going on for the whole week, so, you know, nothing has really changed. A couple minutes later, now I see military personnel on the other side. I see a couple jeeps, a couple guys, you know, guys with the same guns that they had when I seen them around town. I thought this was just regular. But what was unusual was that the uniforms were different. I have never seen these guys in this type of mustard yellow uniform. But they were black, black men. So they're driving closer to these protesters. Young boys, young men, you know, a couple of women out there. And out of nowhere, a guy on top of a Jeep just literally, I mean, just rains fire in a crowd of a couple hundred people. And, I just saw, you know, no remorse. Guy just keeps going. And at this point, it's crazy because people are running away. And as they're running away, you would think he would stop. But he just kept going. He just kept going, kept going, kept going. I literally thought I was dreaming. And I remember just falling to the floor. And the sounds just from this large gun. The gun felt like it was right next to me. My ears were hurting so bad. And you could hear this, you know, just the screams.
I can tell you today there is a big massacre. There are some African crossed to the eastern region to kill our people. Where is Obama? Where is the rest of the world? People are dying on the street. They hear our message. Our people have been killed. Now thousands of demonstrators, ladies, kids, old people, we are here chanting. We don't want Gaddafi anymore.
We plead to the international human organizations and to the UN. Please, please, they will kill us. They will wipe out Benghazi.
I knew that there was no coming back from this people. And I knew for a fact that, this Gaddafi regime wouldn't let this city get away from them without a fight. And I knew that fight would have been catastrophic.
Alex crawls back to his apartment and locks himself in. He calls his teammate Mustafa, his family back home, no answer. He's trapped inside, and he can't go out. Because first of all, there's this connection with Colonel Gaddafi.
They knew I was protected by the Gaddafi family. So it kind of looked like I wasn't on their side. And I wasn't there for them anyway. You know, I was there to play basketball. Second, I didn't really, you know, other than being frightened for my life, I didn't really want anybody to mistake me for, you know, one of these mercenaries that were running the street.
Colonel Gaddafi had hired thousands of African mercenaries to quash the Libyan uprising, and most of the hired men were black, like the guy on the Jeep, like Alex.
When the rebels caught them, they were burning these mercenaries alive. That was going through my mind every time I thought about leaving. And I was like, you know, the best place for me is to be in here. You know, you would think that, okay, people back home might be watching this. You know, your mother might be watching. A couple hundred people died in Benghazi. So you think, you know, as an American, your State Department, you know, they'll send a private jet. You know, the whole Bruce Willis Tears of the Sun thing. It just never happened. You know, it just never happened. It did cross my mind to go outside and help these people, but. You know, when you see dead bodies in the street, mothers dragging their sons, blood spilling in the gutters, it's tough for you to convince yourself that this is part of your fight. Part of your fight.
One day turns into 2 days, then three, and four. But it's hard to keep track, because the shooting never stops.
I lived and survived off literally nothing, like a... It came down to me, you know, drinking water out of a toilet. I remember I had these two flower pots on my windowsill. And then, you know, they were just old and dirty and, you know, I didn't touch them because every time I lifted them up, there were worms under it. And it literally came down to me, you know, getting these worms and putting them inside my body, eating these things, eating cockroaches. You're chewing, you're gagging. Just me talking about it puts a disgusting taste in my mouth. Whatever I needed to eat for me to stay alive or give me another day, I was willing to do it. I was confined in this apartment, this beautiful apartment where, I first walked in, I had a smile on my face. Now I just wanted to get out of here. I was just so angry. This F that, breaking plates, like this fine china, breaking it. Like, you know, this is worthless to me right now. You have all these expensive things on the inside. And I would have traded all those things in for a loaf of bread and a thing of turkey and some cheese. I was searching for a better situation so bad that I was willing to literally live the same way that Gaddafi was feeling. I wanted to taste everything they had. I wanted to live the way they lived and get the most money I could get. While I was doing all this, I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on as far as the way my teammates were living or the other locals. And like I said before, I was kind of ashamed to show my teammates my apartment. They always ask me where I live, but I kind of always change the subject or find some other way to not have them see how I was living. I realized at that point that I could have saw the signs, but that I was just so focused into basketball that I didn't really care about anything else. About 5 or 6 days, I haven't eaten, you know, obviously proper meals. You're sitting in here hearing machine guns go off, bombs go off, almost every minute of the day. You know, at this point, you know, it's sad to say for me because I'm a Christian man, but I lost all faith in God. There was no reason for me to believe anymore. As time went on, I became delusional. I started seeing myself in different forms, like different ages of my childhood. When I was, you know, 4 years old, 8 years old, 15, 20, 25. The 8-year-old version of myself, I was just a wrecking ball. I just remember playing basketball on a milk crate, you know, nailed to a tree, you know, barefoot. And like, those were like good times. I saw the older versions of myself not happy with a scowl on his face. As I got older, I loved the game, but my reasons for playing were different. You know, it was literally just for the notoriety, for the fame. I hated the game of basketball for bringing me there. Literally, I hated the game of basketball. All these years and all this hard work I put in, and it led to this, a massacre. I was done with it. I had a basketball in my apartment. I had a sharp knife, and I literally poked a hole in the basketball. At the 2-week mark, as I'm laying on the floor, I hear this beeping noise. So I rush to the bottom of the bed, and my phone is beeping. And I pick this phone up.
Hello? Alex, is this you? Yeah.
And it's my teammate, Mustafa. I thought I would never hear from this guy ever again.
Mustafa tells Alex that he's found a way to escape to Egypt, that there was a driver willing to smuggle them out. All Alex had to do was make his way to Mr. Ahmed, the team president's office, which is a mile away.
The next day, I try to make a move for it. It took me about 10, 15 minutes to walk down 7 flights of stairs because I was so weak. My knees were buckling every time I walked. By the time I get downstairs, I'm like, you know, there's no way I'm walking almost a mile. And I was about to make my way back upstairs, and I just decided to peek out the front gate of the apartment. I see the same young kids that I was playing with. But instead of having a soccer ball, I've had machetes, handguns, AK-47s. You know, these guns were bigger than them. I made eye contact with one of them. I was actually scared, because he didn't have the same smile on his face. When he saw me, his eyes lit up. Not when he saw me, he just had this stale look on his face. They saw me as somebody that was close to the Gaddafi family. And I was like, man, you know, what's about to happen? He walked over to me. My heart was about to pop out of my chest. I wasn't even looking at him. I was looking down the barrel of that gun. So I stood there. And he tells me to go upstairs. Stay inside. This isn't good for you. He did it to protect me. I told him why I was down here. I was like, I need to go see Mr. Ahmed, who was our team president. And he was telling me no. He was like, the road to his office was blocked. And I said, I need to go. They took me through the back road. One kid on one side and a kid in front of me. Kid behind me with weapons in their hand, holding me. I don't know how many times I must have fell. These kids are picking me back up. These were like four angels God had brought to me. I just remember seeing a lot of blood. It was just a lot of blood. Cars on fire, cars smoked out. And these buildings that I was always familiar with, you know, these little shops and these little small restaurants, now were just burned down. And it just didn't look like the city I came to when I first got there. But I was sad because, you know, you build a relationship with people that you see every day, just walking on the street, waving a hand to, shaking a hand. And literally 2 weeks later, you will never see these people ever again. Did they flee? Did they die? It kind of got to my heart.
The kids drag Alex to the rendezvous point. There, Alex reunites with Mustafa and Mr. Ahmed, while his four young bodyguards take turns defending the building. Inside, Alex finds out that his teammates joined the rebel groups in the uprising, and that some of them didn't make it. When the driver finally arrives, they start the slow, dangerous journey towards a refugee camp in Egypt.
It was like 6 or 7 checkpoints, I remember. Every checkpoint, these rebels will drag you out of the car by your collar. And I was scared because when I get pulled over by a rebel and I show them my Nigerian passport, you know, they probably thought you was some mercenary trying to leave their country. You know, those are some scary times.
It takes 12 hours for Alex to reach the refugee camp, and eventually he makes his way back home.
When I finally got to the U.S. after, you know, I left Egypt, I thought that I could go back to my normal life, you know, hanging out with my friends, going out, having a good time. And I was depressed. I had a friend of mine go buy these pitch black blinds for me so I could sit in my bedroom all day and just sleep. Because if I was up, I would hear these noises of people screaming. I would hear these gunshots. I would hear these bombs going off. And I just, human interaction, I just couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't do it because, you know, I was destroyed. When Muammar Gaddafi was eventually killed, it was sad for me. I cried. I cried instantly because, you know, those tears that I shed were tears of thousands of people that were killed in Libya because the route him and his family took.
When Alex gets home to the U.S., it's a year before his mom convinces him to play ball again.
You know, I'm not playing basketball for the same reasons I played before. It's not about the money. It's not about the notoriety. Like, I love when kids come up to me after a game, and that just puts a smile on my face. Basketball is therapeutic, no matter what happens, win or lose, preferably to win. The only time I could basically get an escape and be calm is within those lines, 94 by 50 in a 40-minute game.
Much love for sharing that story, Alex. Alex now plays with the Worcester Wolves in the British Basketball League. Good luck on this year's championship run. To find out more about Alex's incredible story, check out his book, Gaddafi's Point Guard. We have a link to it on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Davey Kim and Anna Sussman, with sound design by Davey Kim. When Snap returns, a politician you would actually want to vote for? No way. When the Overthrow episode continues, stay tuned. From PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Overthrow episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're examining real cases where the old guard meets the new world order. And for this next story, we travel to the island nation of Iceland. And back in the day, if I said Iceland, you might think hot springs, prosperity, Bjork. But a few years back, this little paradise gained a much more somber type of fame.
In 2008, the people of Iceland took to the streets, banging pots and pans as the prime minister addressed the nation.
And then at the end of his speech, he said, God bless Iceland. And I'd never heard that before or after. A politician asking God to bless us. You have it. but we don't have it that much.
Jan Gunnar grew up in a suburb outside of the capital, Reykjavik. And when he was young, he had a hard time in school. When he was 10, he still couldn't write his three-lettered name.
And that was a big problem for me, you know. I couldn't figure out which way does J turn. Nobody really knew what was wrong with me, but everybody feared, you know, that I was just, you know, stupid. I feared that they were all right. I kind of adopted this way of being the class fool because making people laugh of something that you said or did was better than having them laughing at you for not doing anything. From early age, comedy was a kind of a lifesaver for me because there came something that, you know, was mine. That was something that I created.
So when the banks collapsed and Jan lost his job, he returned to comedy.
Já, hvaða mannvonska og heimska er það að skýra flugvél Fokker?
I made up this politician character, and I called him the simpleton. He was like a simple, happy-go-lucky liar. Fast-talking, fast-thinking, and always, you know, with a smirky smile. He just promised whatever, and bluntly. Free entrance and free towels at the swimming pools, and a polar bear for the zoo. And we can get them for free because sometimes polar bears will swim to the coast of Iceland from Greenland, and they're just shot at sight. So I suggested, or he suggested, or I don't know. It became, I created this character, but slowly this character kind of changed into me back again.
Jan found himself getting pretty consistent feedback after his performances.
People would come up to me and thank me for the show. I really liked it. And I remember I was kind of cornered by a group of very intelligent people. And they were saying, seriously, you should start your own political party and just run, you know. And I was saying, well, explaining to them, well, it's part of my program, you know, it's just an idea. Yes, we know, but it's a great idea. You should do it. It felt ridiculous and it felt very funny, but at the same time, it felt so right, you know. I mean, what is politics and political representatives? I mean, they're just people and some of them make a mess. Why don't more people like me go into politics? Why don't more creative people get politically involved? And everything in me said kind of yes. You are probably the only man, only person who can step into this and have a positive effect on it. So I decided that I would run for prime minister. I went down to the National Registry and I said, is it complicated to register a political party? No, it's just, you know, you have to fill out this form. And it cost almost nothing. And I called it the best party. Prior to that, I had been thinking about calling it the cool party. And we would only promise to do cool things and not uncool things. And absolutely nothing corny. So, but I went for best. It sounded more stupid.
Next, Jan needed to recruit party members. He randomly messaged people he thought could be good for the job. When they asked if this was going to take a lot of their time,
No, not at all, I would say. No, I just need a name and your photo, and I'll just crop a photo of Facebook, so don't bother. You don't have to send me a photo. And they were all glad to help.
And the best party became official.
We announced the birth of the best party in a shopping mall. And that was at that meeting when I realized that I was running for mayor. I thought I was running for minister.
Wait, so you really didn't know you had signed up to run for mayor?
Not in the beginning, no.
Jan took his campaign to the streets. He stayed true to his sketch character and threw promises around like confetti. He'd travel to nursing homes and promise the residents that his speeches would never put them to sleep. He'd tell classrooms of kindergartners that he was going to build a Disneyland in Reykjavik.
I like to go on stage unprepared. I like the tension of it. I would just go to some address and there would be some people and I would do my best from there. I was never sure what they thought. When the first polls started to come out, it's like 8 weeks prior to the election. There was a small percentage, not even a whole percentage, of people that intended to vote for the best party. It was like a 0.5 or 0.7% people.
In typical Jan Gunnar fashion, he declared the polls a landslide victory. He was having fun.
I was a guest in an Icelandic talk show, and in the makeup there was this woman who greeted me and said hello and hi. And is it right, you know, what I hear, that you have started your own political party? And yeah, that's correct. And she said, okay, that's great news. Good luck with it. Oh, thank you. I said, and then she left, and I asked the makeup artist there, who was that? And she said, you really don't know who this is? No. That's the mayor of Reykjavik. that's the person you're running up against. And I didn't know.
But then in the next polls, the best party came in at 10% of the vote. And all of a sudden, he was a serious contender. Jan was invited to televise debates with the other candidates. And during one such debate, they were all asked about what was then a very important issue in Reykjavik, whether or not the airport should be moved.
I hadn't prepared for this. I hadn't really thought about it. And I said,
well, I've never moved an airport. I don't know how you go about moving an airport. I will look into it.
And after this, I felt awful. I felt so bad. And I was, you know, thinking to myself, who do you think you are? Why are you getting yourself into this? I mean, these are clever people. You know nothing. You have no idea what you're doing. Now everybody sees how stupid you are.
But after the debate aired, people that Jan knew, and even strangers on the street, came up to him and thanked him for his honesty. It was the first time they'd heard a candidate admit that they were uninformed on an issue. And then the best party polled at 20%.
I changed my methods a bit after this. I allowed myself to be more serious, and I tried to do it without becoming dull. And I studied different topics that were being discussed in debates. 2 weeks before the elections, there was a poll that showed like everybody was just going to more or less vote for us.
But naturally, as Jan's popularity grew, his opponents started taking him more seriously and ramping up their attacks.
And instead of, you know, having fun and saying nonsense things, I was suddenly in the position where I had to defend myself. I had to start explaining things. And I mean, that's a method. That's something that you can do with
with a gesture, you know. Get him to explain himself and explain the jokes, and immediately he will cease to be funny. You kill the magic, you know, with explanation, and that's what politicians are quite good at doing.
Jan knew his opponent saw him as a threat, and that's when he started having second thoughts.
Am I really going to get myself into city council and become the mayor? So I had to sit down with my wife and children, and we had to discuss this and my doubts. And they said, it's not about you. It's about something bigger than just you. And you're inspired. I mean, just the idea is inspiring people. It's giving people hope that it's not all lost, and we're not all losers, and you know, we can actually make a difference.
Still, the prospect of actually becoming mayor gave him nightmares.
This is just getting too brutal, you know. It's too aggressive. I don't think I can handle this. You know, I wanna back out. You know, I don't want to be. You know, I don't have to want to have to spend many years with these people. Then I decided to withdraw.
And the day after, there was a big rally in the university in Reykjavik, and one after the other, they went up to the podium and had a speech. And when it was my turn, I told people about my doubts and my second thoughts about the whole thing, and I wasn't really sure. And as I was speaking, I was also thinking what I should do. And it was one of those moments when I feel myself getting unprepared on stage. And I said the last days, I felt everything had been getting so serious. I have actually decided to withdraw from the election. But in behind me, there were the other politicians. They couldn't hide the genuine happiness for my absence. And as I said it, I focused on people's faces and people's eyes. I was like, no, you can't, no. And I think I just decided it there on the spot when I saw people's reaction. And it's like with theater. I mean, there are certain rules that you cannot really break. You cannot break the relationship with the audience, because then everything's lost. And then I waited a few seconds, and then I said,
joke. Hérna. Það fyrst að vera gaman núna. Og ég risin úr öskunni.
On June 15th, 2010, Jan Gunnar was sworn in as the mayor of Reykjavik. Or to quote one of his greatest fans, Lady Gaga, the mayor of Iceland. Jan entered parliament surrounded by six of his dearest Facebook friends, and the best party now accounted for almost half of city council. But after the victory parties were through, Jan found himself in charge of a city reeling from financial collapse.
The seriousness of the financial situation had been kept a secret, and politicians were reluctant to admit how serious it was. But I didn't have any interests at stake, and they couldn't sack me. I would have to resign.
When Jan got to office, the only promise he kept was his promise to break all of his promises.
So instead of a free entrance to swimming pools and a free towel, I raised the entrance fee to the swimming pools and to the buses and electricity and hot water, and that was not popular.
Jan didn't stop there. He merged schools to cut costs. He refused to dine with the leaders of NATO, and he involved Reykjavik citizens in government decisions. And it worked. Almost all of it. And then, after 4 years, the longest he'd ever kept a job, his term was up. And he decided not to run again.
The best party was a kind of like a surprise party. You were just minding your own business, and then suddenly the lights are on and everybody's happy and all your friends are there. And that was the best party. Surprise parties don't stay surprise all evening. They become a regular party sooner or later. And you cannot do the surprise again. You cannot turn off the light, turn on the light, and everybody goes, oh, surprise! It doesn't work, you know, because the magic is gone.
Now he's proved to himself, to Iceland, and to the world that he isn't joking. With a track record to back him up, he could now run as an accomplished politician.
I go out in the store and there's an old man there, you know. He sees me and he starts talking with me and, you know, are you going to run for president? Many people are asking me about it.
So are you ready for that? Are you ready to present yourself to the world without this protection of comedy?
That's exactly what I'm not sure of. The comfort of comedy is very good. Some part of me wants to do it, and another part of me can't think of it, you know.
Bad news, snappers. Jan just announced he's not going to run in the upcoming elections. But no worries, we're rooting for you anyway, Jan. Thanks so much for sharing your story. If you want to find out more, pick up a copy of Jan's memoir, Gnar, or just watch the documentary by the same name. We'll have links on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Adlerstein, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. It's that time. But understand, it's never over. Get full episodes, hours of amazing storytelling delivered. Subscribe to the free Snap Judgment podcast, snapjudgment.org. The Snap Nation conversation, catch us on Twitter or Facebook. Now, Snap was produced by myself and a team that would never foment a rebellion. And then right, y'all. Please salute the enforcer himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat, the hammer, Masidi Miller, the instigator, and assessment. Julia, the wiretap DeWitt. Nancy, Trigger Finger Lopez. The whistleblower, Joe Rosenberg. Renzo, the saboteur Gorio. Our Snap infiltration crew, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, and Leon Morimoto. Matt Ducott makes me look good. Jasmine Aguilera makes me look better, because that's what's important. Did you ever break into the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and rifle through their secret documents? Well, here's a tip. The password is password. Many thanks to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, did not find your credit card number on the internet and use it to purchase vintage Atari video game consoles. No! PRX.org. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could look up your house on Google Earth, stick your hand outside the window, only to see that same hand appear right there on your computer screen, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.